this is a discussion, which means that I'm not especially well prepared, but I'm also, unfortunately, not especially badly prepared. So
it's going to be disgusting.
Right. What I think maybe we should do is I will flip through a large collection of slides really, really fast so that everybody can see what we could discuss, and for which I have backup pictures and movies and other things. And then I'll go right back to the beginning, and we'll take things much more slowly and go to whichever point people find interesting. So, to begin with, I have here a movie, and I have actually a number more movies scattered throughout that I can get to fairly quickly. It shows a numerical simulation of a two-dimensional model in which a block is picked up and just pushed against a rigid table, and you can see a self-healing pulse that develops and runs. So that's one of the things we could talk about. The vertical axis, you might notice, has been increased in that upper thing by a factor of 25 to make the features apparent to the movie-going public.
Block of what?
Elastic stuff that doesn't need to be specified in much detail. This is basically a pure elasticity and rupture. Right, the similar elastic stuff. So one of the topics that we can talk about is what are the simple mechanics of bringing together materials with different elastic constants.
So you're getting self-healing breakaway.
Yes.
Is this the real time travel? Sort of, you know, also translating time and
reference frame. The cameraman is following front and back of the pulse in the lower frames. And also, I guess the upper frame, once it threatens to move out of view, the cameraman also follows that. So it's traveling, now it's steady state, but the camera is traveling. Yeah, when it comes within range, when the atom gets within a certain range of the lower surface, the bond reforms.
And you have an interaction.
Yes. Right. Which is weak. There's no friction law. It put in. Right. There's a weak attraction between these atoms and those atoms. And there's a stronger interaction between the upper ones, and then the bottom surface is very strong indeed. The interaction used here, although I'll have examples that become more complicated, but the example that happens to have been used here is one where the potential is linear and then just fails. So once again, we're in the snapping bond territory, which is basically pure linear elasticity supplemented with a teeny tiny little nonlinear rule, the simplest you could possibly have, which is you're linear and then you fail, plus whatever you get by having the material be discrete, and after that it's all Newton's laws. Excuse me? At the boundaries in this particular system, there is some dissipation, and that is meant to, if that's set up in such a way as to mimic outgoing radiation conditions. So I could say, no, I don't have dissipation, I simply have an infinite system and waves travel away forever. But actually, I implement that idea with a ramp, the exponentially ramped damping region at the boundaries to mimic it. Correct. So you have weak adhesion, and the dynamical condition for this and things like it to start happens to look very friction-like. So if you took a block like this and you suppose that the reason it moves is that things like this get going, then you ask, as a function of how hard you push down, how hard do you have to push to the side, the answer is it looks like friction with a coefficient of friction of about 0.2.
But one of the things that we could get into discussing is that if you actually would do an experiment of a piece of solid contact, the friction would not be proportional to load, and the limit we would have to do contact.
If this mechanism were operating, then it would be.
No, but experimental measurements in system, typically in the limit of zero load, there is a very large friction for adhesive, perfect contact of this kind.
Well, this model, actually, you have to exceed a threshold for the friction-like thing to take place. Below that, you've got adhesion and can't get away from it. And where exactly that threshold sits is almost certainly temperature dependent. But at zero temperature, it's a fairly large threshold. For this linear law to take over, you have to actually push sideways with the normal and compressive forces have to exceed a threshold for this linear rule to take place. Below that, you've got adhesion and you're just stuck, and it doesn't look linear. That's sort of a little secret at the bottom of some of the graphs I have later. You're applying a constant displacement at the at the top. Actually, what you're doing is it's a constant horizontal displacement at the top boundary, which is maintained forever. No. Just a constant. You start with the block and you displace. You push it down by a set amount and you displace it at the top by a set amount, and then you just wait. Actually, the initial conditions here are done a little differently, but when you're in steady state, that's what's happening. So this one is set up so that this one pulse relieves most or all of the horizontal displacement, and it just runs forever doing that.
What you call a pulse is an opening in the lattice?
Yeah. We could call it a pulse. We could call it a self-healing crack. We could call it a slip pulse. Anyway, that's just it's a possible solution of this mechanical system, which is a solution of Newton's laws. Maybe, if that's what this is. I think that's debatable. That's one of the things we should get to. Yes. If I make it incommensurate, I haven't played with it, it certainly matters. And the right way to play with it, I haven't. There are lots and lots and lots of things that I would like to do to extend this. And basically, I haven't done them. Huge numbers of them.
That's right, sure, zero.
Yeah.
But I think you know for the incommensurate case that if the interaction, the interface aren't too big, then there's no resistance to sliding, and therefore no way for shear stress to build up.
Right.
Necessary to manipulate the front.
Right.
Some mechanism, another way of saying that is there has to be some mechanism of creating an interfacial strength.
And I would be inclined to add that by putting in something that would mimic what a monolayer of organics would do. They figure out, they basically make your lattice commensurate by just hooking things up themselves. And so I would put in something like that. And I'm not quite sure how I would do it, but I would do it. If you watch it from the beginning, you see how this thing starts. It does start with the pre-existing notch. Let's look right at the beginning. This initial condition is actually the block a little bit tilted, and then it's pushed down with the front hitting first and the back a little bit open, and then the structure forms from there. If I just start with the thing flat on the table, I'm not sure what it would take to get it all going. I think it would just... It doesn't just start. It just sits there. It doesn't do anything. So there, that's the initial condition. Starting with a long notch, the back end is up, then the whole thing is rammed down and to the side, and then then you stop moving it, the boundaries are fixed, and it runs from there. Excuse me? No gravity. That's mechanics. Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll get to that. If I get to that, I'll get to that.
Also, do you have something with like an atom stability here? It seems like it's kind of focusing.
You mean a daughter crack?
The squeezing of the pulse as it propagates.
I don't know. It goes into some steady state and then it just runs in that shape. That's the steady state by there. It just runs like that forever, pretty much.
Cut off by a finite number of latitudes, like the scale of these things are...
This is length 76. This is 76 atoms long. 78, 79, changes a little bit. I mean, it's dynamical. Right. And I have the continuum solutions, which ought to help. So the what we have actually are analytical solutions for the front end, analytical solutions for the back end. We do not have analytical discrete solutions for a self-healing pulse, but we have continuum solutions for the self-healing pulse. So the way the most elaborate calculations went was to get the start with the continuum solution for something that looks like that. And there's an inner, there's a singularity at the two tips, which you can calculate within the continuum. From the analytical solutions front and back, you get an outer singularity as you go out, which goes asymptotically to the continuum one, and so match. And so when I plot, you know, thousands and thousands of solutions and big families of them, that's how those were generated. They had to be get the right continuum stuff at the large scale, and then they had to match into this analytically determined continuum, lattice stuff at small scales. These are in 2D. Do I have any? No, I don't have any in 3D. Haven't done this problem in 3D. I could. In fact, later I'll show you. I have one of the buttons I can click on actually just brings up a molecular dynamics program that does this, and so I could change some parameters and I could make it 3D. But I won't try to do that in front of you now, although it's tempting. It would run slower. Okay, so that's. I think this is a pretty good introduction to the interface pulse stuff, and we can come back to this movie. Let me just flip through quickly things I have assembled, and then we'll go back and just sort of take it by ear. So I can talk a little bit about the fact that you can solve atomic scale models and the sorts of things that go in and the sorts of things that you get out. I have, because Michael, you asked about the physical reason for the velocity gap. So I have a physical argument which I can share. I can talk about the fact that you can make it as large or as small as you want in three ways. Number one, you can change the shape of a potential. And I have an example of a familiar potential that does that. Number two, you can change the temperature. And number three, you can change dissipation. And I can tell you the separate effects of those three things on lattice trapping and velocity gaps. And I can tell you about the history and, well, just the idea of self-healing cracks and interfaces and why they were thought to be mathematically troublesome and why Friend objected that they probably couldn't exist at all. And some of the weird mathematical things that happen, which I think are worth knowing. Those are some exact solutions on interfaces. I can mention a little bit about the stress rotation, which Jay mentioned. And the way stress rotation changes with speed and Poisson ratio in the material. And then putting it all together into a phenomenological picture of friction, which may or may not apply in any material that's ever been found. And I have more movies, and that's about it. So, come on, this picture takes too long to load. Let me go back to the beginning and just ask what people would like to hear about.
Are there any experimental results for these things?
Yes. There are. So I would have to hunt a little bit to find pictures, but I'll tell you some of the things that I know about.
So just before you, this is going back, you have, it's isotropic elasticity, but you don't know one for. It's not just you have wires up to the top, or is that?
Okay, just a second. So, okay, so here is a numerical solution of a model that can be solved analytically.
Which is, has the full 2D.
Right. Right. So that, I'm just running a numerical solution, but that happens to be a case which can be solved analytically, and it can be solved analytically for arbitrary heights, which in practice means heights up to about 20,000, after which the integrals become sufficiently singular that it's challenging and there seems nothing to gain. So I've never gone beyond heights of about 20,000. This is mode one. So you can go up to what you can solve analytically are more or less arbitrarily complicated linear models which are discrete, which have a rupture, which have a crack in them, and in which there's only one nonlinearity, which is that at some threshold, which you can define as you wish, bonds give way and go to a different linear law, which is usually taken to be zero.
You need to know where that surface is.
Yes. Furthermore, if you want to do this analytically, the change between one linear regime and another better occur at evenly spaced intervals along a straight line. So that's the condition. If you assume that there is this rupture, that bond breaks like that, then you can take a pretty much arbitrarily complicated linear model of everything else, solve the additional linear problem, map everything, and then because of the assumption that things are breaking in sequence, you have a time symmetry that takes care of the horizontal direction. Everything in the problem maps onto a piecewise linear problem on a single mass point lying on the crack line. You solve analytically for everything above with the Green's function for a discrete problem, and those exist, and there are techniques to find them. It's actually usually, although the algebra may be bad, it's straightforward, painful algebra if you get to mode one. And then you have this mixed boundary condition, because for negative infinite times the bond is intact, and for positive times the bond is broken. That is a type of boundary value problem that can be solved by Wiener-Hopf techniques, and that you can do it. So the whole thing reduces to an integral.
How does your fixed solution compare with all the other fixed solutions around?
Well, do you mean cohesive zone models?
Well, down flat, white, the intervals, or whatever they are.
For these materials, they're by and large wrong. In other words, if you gave me atoms that had these force laws, then I have not been able to find a physically sensible way to obtain limits in which you get something out like a cohesive zone. And the reason for that is that I can cook something up. I can tell you how I could cook something up that would give something like a cohesive zone, but the basic problem is that the extensions of forces tend to be comparable to interparticle spacings, whatever scale you're looking on. If you're in a polymer, then you can sensibly talk about mass units that might be separated by 10 nanometers, but then the scale on which the forces cut off tends to be 10 nanometers too. And so long as the extent of your forces and the separation of your discrete masses are comparable, then anything like a cohesive zone tends to have a scale comparable to your interparticle spacing, and you don't, in my experience, have a sensible continuum limit in which a cohesive zone emerges.
You also constrain yourself to be linear, so you can't really have dissipation outside of what's.
Sure you can. That's linear. You can have all the dissipative stuff you want.
The assumption of continuum mechanics is that the discretization is somehow not important.
Right. Well, I will show you a Leonard Jones solid where the interactions are moderately long range, and already in that case, just with second Niebuhr interactions under Leonard Jones, the lattice trapping almost vanishes.
Yeah.
There is a small range which is hard to find but possible to find in which you do not have any dislocations emerging, and in which a perfect brittle crack runs through a Leonard Jones solid, and I'll show you that in a second. Yes. Right, but already by the time you get to next nearest neighbor, the effects are beginning to get small.
There are those who state that any nearest neighbor model is inherently not appropriate because it's near field.
Well, not appropriate for what?
Well, looking at Eisenbald, for example, you'll find insists that you go to far field. Maybe mean field approximation. So then, if you look at slider block models, which are sort of in the spirit, you get extremely different results if you go to longer range rather than nearest neighbor.
Well, I coupled this with supercomputer calculations on what people have thought to be the most realistic potentials available for silicon and for oxide glasses. Those are fairly short range, although not nearly short range as this, and the phenomenology is very, very similar. And that is extended up to and includes the most recent studies with tight binding quantum mechanics. So I think that for the fracture of brittle solids, and I don't know for sure whether this includes gels, but maybe it does. For the fracture of brittle solids, near-neighbor interactions are fine. I don't know of any particular evidence to the contrary. I didn't say nearest neighbor, but near neighbor.
And why is this so unmappable onto,
Well, to begin with, so dissipation happens in a number of different phases. And in the first phase, dissipation happens through high-frequency vibrations that are generated by the motion of the tip. And that is capable generically of consuming about double the energy that goes into breaking bonds. At that point, these very smooth, clean solutions become unstable, and the first thing they become unstable to, if the potentials have a brittle character, is to the snapping of bonds just behind the crack tip, off the crack line. And as you put more and more energy in, the distance that those extra snaps go becomes larger and larger and larger and larger, and you develop a larger and larger process zone of extra broken bonds. Whether those are micro cracks or whether those are dislocations starts to depend a lot on whether you're in 2D, 3D, the tails of the potentials. And there's also, as I will tell you, a large dependence upon temperature. And finally, a lot of the dynamics can depend on whether or not you add dissipative rules to the dynamics, which you're free to do. And you can put dissipation wherever you want. And just as long as it's linear, basically it's really easy to add arbitrary anelasticity.
It's a general point of view that the forces binding the last material are many more than magnitude higher than the forces that result in rupture. So
yeah, that's true.
So here you're sort of dealing with a perfect elastic material.
Yeah. But the forces you apply at the boundaries are vastly smaller than the ones that lead to rupture. This contains as a special case all of linear elastic fracture mechanics. That's one thing to keep in mind. That's completely in all of those models, particularly the mode 1 model, contains everything linear elastic fracture mechanics has, and then you can add other things. You can add a specific physical rupture criterion, and you can add arbitrary anelastic effects.
You might argue that
No, I don't think you'd argue that even in a highly dislocated metal. Even in a highly dislocated metal, and I'm mainly speaking about silicon, where if you have even a few dislocations in a centimeter scale sample, it's deadly for the electronics, and so you don't. But even in a highly dislocated metal, what's the spacing? It's typically, I think, about 1,000 atoms between the dislocation, even if you have a lot of them. So on this scale, if you were looking at the fracture of a metal, if you could have a clean crack running like this, I think the picture would look very much like this, and then every now and then you'd hit a dislocation. Of course, you're dragging them along, so that they're consuming all the energy, the dragging.
But what happens when you try to do a simulation metal dislocation is that the crack goes once, right?
I don't know. And the reason I don't know is that if you just took Stillinger-Weber out of the box and ran a simulation with that, then the crack tip would blunt. Now that clearly violates experiment. That's just wrong. So the potential, Stillinger-Weber potential out of the box is wrong, as are almost all potentials that have ever been proposed for silicon. And okay, Stillinger-Weber is the favorite potential for studying silicon. And it gets the crack tip dynamics sufficiently clearly wrong. I mean, it just, the energy is way too big, inconsistent with experiment. So to get Stillinger-Weber, I mean, you can patch it up, at which point you've ruined the Stillinger-Weber potential. What does the tip look like when you use just... Oh, the potential? Okay, just a second. It's a very long expression. It doesn't help from...
It's like a two-body interaction plus a three-body interaction that's made to constrain
the atoms to be... Right. I can give you... So some. It gets the melting temperature right by design. But it doesn't get brittle fracture right, and it doesn't predict the fracture energies right within a factor of 10. And it doesn't Right. So you're telling me what metals do, but I don't know whether that's because the tips of in metals really give out dislocations, or because, just as was true for silicon, all the metal potentials are wrong, and whether they should, at low temperatures at least, support very sharp tips, which, however, have to drag an enormous dislocation cloud with them. And I don't know. I don't know. There was a lot of talk about this dislocation-free zone near the tip that occupied, you know, many, many years, and I don't know what the resolution of all of that is. And Sid, what do you think?
It's reminded of a simulation of Fred Abraham.
Yeah.
He's a billion atoms, and he has two crack tips aiming each other, spitting out dislocations. And dislocation loops entangle, form a huge mess. That's what people think. First approximation is what's happening in a lot of dislocations. And they have a lot of time for them to organize because they find patterns and so on. So it's really a question of what kind of detail
you will
need to put into
the thing.
Very scary.
Well, that's Leonard Jones. I even have that movie here, and I can bring it up. But I don't think there is... I've not seen direct evidence that that's actually what happens. I just know that people think that's what happens.
Let me put it another way. From the large scale, the elastic fraction of things,
right.
And you know how much energy is going in.
Right.
Compare that to the ideal Griffith criteria.
Right.
The surfaces you're creating.
Right.
You can also use that to figure out how the stress varies as you approach the crack tip.
Right.
At what point the stress reaches the limit of elastic behavior, the onset of elastic behavior in the material.
Right.
And if you look at something like silicon, the experiments tell you that would be a very small length scale.
Right.
If you look at that for metals, they tell you that would be a length scale of more than micron.
Right.
And so you know that the elastic description must fail, within that length scale. And that's all you know. And
then that leads to what's called the Rice paradox. So let me because I'll propose that, look, I said I don't know, and I really mean that, but I'll propose a resolution of the Rice paradox. Okay, so what is the Rice paradox? If I recall, it's very natural to say that once one gets down to these micron scales, that one must replace the linear elastic theory with a plastic theory, because the metal starts flowing plastically. So now you construct a plastic solution around the tip, and under a broad range of assumptions, the problem is that this plastic zone completely consumes all the energy that comes in, and there's no singularity left, and there is no way to account for any bond breaking. So my proposed resolution is to say that there is a lower scale. Plasticity is fine for a while, down to the scales where plasticity can work. And plasticity works down to the scales in which you can smear out over dislocations. So now let's go to a highly dislocated metal and ask what that scale is. And, I don't know, 10th of a micron or something like that. So I propose on scales much lower than that, you stop seeing the dislocations and you see something looks more like a crystal again. And that crack tips look a lot sharper. Maybe they emit some dislocations, maybe they don't. The energy involved with those is not so important anyway. It's really the big cloud that matters and the continuum plasticity. And that the mic, right down on the scale with the tip, goes back to looking more like that again.
I love a lot of the screens that you've been able to
All of that happens at a larger scale with the plastic zone. Yeah. As I said, I don't know whether it's atomically sharp or not, and it probably isn't perfectly atomically sharp. But I think the view that somehow down on the atomic scale you necessarily have this enormous cloud of dislocations might have trouble accounting for the brittle fracture of steel. So, yes, Sid?
You know, people trying to understand brittle ductile transition.
Right.
And for a long time there was this Rice-Thompson theory.
Right.
85 or so, and around 1990 or so there was the Rice piles.
Right.
And then Ali Argon and some others found out that what really governs the brittle ductile transition is not so much the nucleation or migration dislocation, it's really the local ledge imperfections at a crack tip. All you need is a step. And that can nucleate dislocation like crazy, completely eliminate that anything else that you might have to talk to. If you pick that ledge imperfection to account, then you can actually get the brittle ductile transition for iron around room temperature. Previously, people really like melting pumps, way over. So, what seems to be controlling is an extrinsic effect. All you need is a slight imperfection. It's true, in silicon, you can make it very, very perfect. But in things like alpha iron, that's what people think is all it takes to give you the kind of experimental correlation.
That's fine, but then below the brittle ductile transition, what's happening?
Well,
you're talking about, so above it, you're spewing dislocations like mad.
Right.
Below it, what's happening?
You can get dislocations and you will not get dislocations. I mean, you know.
Okay, I'm going to move on because there are...
any mechanism at all in dislocation, then you're back to being having a brittle material. And if they can't run away from the crack, maybe you raise the tension, you load it fast enough, so they can't get away, then you're back to a brittle material. Is this correct? Or might kind of
particularly if they can't move very fast far away, because it's this very long length scale over which you have lots of them that gives you the biggest enhancement.
So then essentially you're back to this picture with a sequence of dislocation, that's fine because you're still going to get brittle fracture.
As I said, I don't know. But I'll still maintain that despite everything everyone says or believes, it's not clear to me what things look like for brittle fracture, even of metals, on very small scales.
But by brittle fracture, again, typically that would mean that the energy we're putting in is not so different.
No, even brittle fracture of metals, you're consuming vastly more than the Griffith energy. I think that the in steel, don't you go from something like 1,000 times the Griffith energy to 10,000 when you go through the brittle ductile transition? Sid, is that right?
I don't know. If I think of model physics, I don't think
the Griffith is the right one.
I think the Griffith criterion is the right criterion for idealizing more fracture. I believe that. In the early days, people found 3-4 times more. That's because that bonding condition. If you do it properly, I think this can be controlled.
Anyway, I'm going to go on because we haven't gotten to interface stuff yet. And I would like to, nor have we gotten to the velocity gap. One of the features, when you solve these models exactly, or when you do great big supercomputer calculations with more realistic potentials, there is a range of velocities that is forbidden in steady state. Not for accelerating cracks, but in steady state. Just can't get them. So either they are stuck and they don't move, or they run really fast, order sound speed. And that has not been observed experimentally. So, since it's arguable that matter is actually made of atoms, the question is, why is it then that all calculations that you do on these atomic scale systems give the phenomenology like this, and yet if you go to the lab, it really doesn't look like this? And so I can tell you three different sorts of ways that this effect becomes much, much smaller or goes away.
What's delta here?
Delta is K1 over K1C, a dimensionless measure of loading relative to the Griffith point.
So this diagram is for the mode winding crack?
Yes.
So the same thing though you're saying would apply to the pulses on the interface?
Yes.
And then you had mentioned that there's also a gap there with respect to the straps, that at most straps you don't see right pulses. Is that for the same?
Yes. Uh-huh. So I believe that would go away for in the interface cracks for all the reasons that I know it goes away in these.
If you just want to define the P wave velocity, that's what the velocity is?
The P wave velocity, so this is, let's see, this is relative to the shear wave speed. And in this model, oh gee, I forget, but it's somewhere up around 2. Yes.
So this is the shear velocity.
Right. Shear velocity is 1. Rayleigh wave speed is around 0.9. Longitudinal is up above that. I forget where exactly.
So if you were driving instead of a constant force with some displacement.
This is all displacement driving. Always displacement driving.
So can't you, if you tried to drive at a velocity less, just think at a rate that would correspond to a velocity less than this, can you get a stick foot?
I'll show you what happens. I have a movie. I think. Oh, shoot. Maybe I don't have it in this talk. Well, what you can set up, so if you have fixed displacement loading, what you can do is you can... I'd have to bring up a different talk, I'm afraid.
But anyway, you should be able to get into a regime where the crack will suddenly spurt forward to release some of the strain and stop.
No, what happens is you gently lower the boundary. You go down and down and down in speed. You hit this speed, and the thing just stops dead. And that's it. Jumps to this branch.
That's because you have perfectly rigid
boundaries. Right. If you had, if you were dragging them along, then you would get stick slip.
Or if you were opening up with some compliant material that has
yes.
Bend, like tape, for example, you get stick slip and fracture the tape back in interface.
Yeah, because you've got a hysteresis loop. I can show you, I think I have them later. I have computer simulations, and you do get a hysteresis loop, so you would get stick slip under the appropriate loading conditions. Okay, so I can give you a physical argument for the velocity gap, but I'll only give that on request. I'm going to go ahead to how you get rid of it first. And then if you want to know where it comes from, because I use the argument about where it comes from to figure out how to get rid of it, but I'll tell you three ways to get rid of it. Number one, you can make lattice trapping as large or as small as you want by changing the shape of a potential. And I have here two potentials you could apply between atoms that will make it A, very large, and B, very small. They're just crooked up for the moment. To make it really, really large, you have a potential that grows very slowly, and then there's an enormous peak with very little area under it just before failure. That will give you a huge lattice trapping effect. Because you have to apply a very large force to get over this place, but there's not very, very much energy required to get over. So that gives you big lattice trapping. Lots of force and big velocity gap. Although the mathematical connection between those two has never been spelled out. Empirically, any system which has large lattice trapping also has large velocity gap. But I've never actually seen the mathematical connection spelled out. How do you make it really, really small? By having the reverse. Large energy, small force. So a way to get that is to have a small initial rise, and then almost all the energy is contained in something where the potential is going down. So let me think for a second. The axes are cut off. I've been misspeaking. These are forces, not potentials. That makes more sense now. I've plotted forces. So you go up a little bit, and then the force decreases very slightly. You've reached the peak here, and most of the energy is spent in a range where the force isn't going up anymore. So that leads to a lattice trapping as small as you want, and I've actually worked that out analytically and shown that you can have a lattice trapping potential that's arbitrarily small that way.
Is this really a repulsive force, or is this the...
This is the attractive force between neighbors.
Right.
It's the attractive force between near neighbors. So you can have purely nearest neighbor interactions, but arbitrarily small lattice trapping with a force that looks like that. That's a function of deviation from equilibrium separation.
Before, you're using just the fine.
Right. Now, what about a slightly more realistic example? Slightly. This is a solution of Leonard Jones with second nearest neighbor interactions. Note these velocities are negative and correspond to healing solutions. These are positive. And this is in units, again, of the shear wave speed. This is slightly odd stuff, but there's almost no lattice trapping at all. Solutions start here. No measurable lattice trapping. There's a tiny little region where you're applying, I don't know, 0.01% more than the Griffith criterion would tell you, and you haven't started moving yet, but then you start going up. The first velocity is as small as the computer can measure. You go up. Curiously, there are all these plateaus. It's not as if there aren't interesting things from a dynamical systems perspective. There are lots of them. And then there's this huge, long plateau, which is flat to numerical resolution. And then you get an instability. Notice that you're still only a 2% above the Griffith strain over the whole course of this plot, and then the solutions go unstable. Crack branching, but what actually happens is the thing stops because it emits, this is fairly ductile, emits a dislocation, blunts and stops. And then you have to pull much, much harder to get anything to go again. So this is the system which has been used often as a, sort of a conceptual model for things like copper and ductile crystals, but it does contain a very, very narrow, completely brittle branch if you study it really carefully.
Or two dimensions along a particular...
Right, along a particular plane, right. And if you tilt it even slightly, then you lose this stuff, too.
What is the bigger lattice trapping?
No, blunts. Again, it will send off a dislocation. There's a narrow range of angles where this will persist, and then once you exceed that, you send off blunting stuff and it stops, and then you have to pull much harder and all the dynamics look totally different. And a lot of that is special to 2D. So, right. So that's the second way. Let's see, that's the first way you can get rid of lattice trapping. Change the potential, go to more nearest neighbors, don't have a big peak. Next, just crank up the temperature. This is a modified Stillinger Weber at temperatures up to 300 Kelvin. And at 300 Kelvin, there you can go up, you can go down. There's no evidence of hysteresis. There's no evidence of lattice trapping, except for the fact that you don't start until you're above the Griffith, the minimal Griffith point. But this would be identified experimentally as the Griffith point. Go up, down, no velocity gap, nothing. But go down to 0 Kelvin, and on this scale, there's a large hysteresis loop. And this is 3D.
This is 3D.
This is 3D.
Wouldn't you expect that this would be dependent upon the time you spend ramping up to the displacement?
This is done in the slow limit. This took months of 64 nodes of a T3E. So I claim this is the adiabatic limit. We took it, we kept going down and down and down in loading rate until the curves didn't change anymore. And we had analytical estimates of how slowly we had to do it, and then we went several times slower than that. Right. Yeah, it's imposed at the boundaries. So there are these damping regions at the boundaries of the system, and we use fluctuation dissipation there. There's no kicking near the tip. So that's second way you can get rid of lattice trapping and velocity gaps. And there's a third way, which is you can just put in big dissipative law, like I have here, lots of Kelvin dissipation. Okay, Kelvin dissipation isn't very realistic. I can give you other laws. You give me any dissipation law in frequency space, and I can stick it in there. So here you go. And once again, lattice trapping gone. And there we have systems of different heights solved in the presence of great big Kelvin dissipation. Yeah.
You had mentioned that, well, there's a velocity gap here in this crystal-based system. Is there really a reason to think that that velocity gap in the shell would be aligned? That one or more of these things wouldn't have copied the lattice or velocity gap in the shell?
I don't know. I mean, this is, you'd have to give me a specific system, and then we have to actually ask what its dissipation constants are. And they're not of the Kelvin form. They're actually this constant Q form. And so that goes into the whole story of how you fit dissipation in these models. I think this is really big. I think this may be unphysically big. And anyway, I'm not sure if it's legitimate to take something with discrete mass points and forces and stick dissipation in. I mean, maybe it's okay, maybe it's not. I can certainly solve it, but I think we could have lots of arguments about whether this is a really good model to construct. But anyway, that sort of outlines the space of stuff you can solve. Since nominally there's only even 5 minutes left, let me at least mention some of the implications for interface stuff. I mean, I guess we can go on as long as we want, but I don't want to hold people hostage. I guess anybody can just leave. But interface stuff. There are two families of solutions of sliding pulses on interfaces. One of them, I think most of you are more familiar with, and I don't know all that much about them. Mathematically, they correspond to solutions in which you have an upper material and a lower material, and the upper material is constrained to remain flat, but part of it can slide. Now, there's a different mathematical problem that you can pose, which is just a little bit different. Instead of imposing a displacement condition on the bottom surface, you impose some sort of stress condition on the bottom surface. For example, you might say that over some region, stresses on a portion of the bottom surface vanish. And that corresponds to a wave of separation, in which an upper surface lifts off of a lower one. Now, if you think about sliding a brittle thing over a brittle thing and ask how much would it have to raise itself physically so that the forces from the lower one would vanish, the answer is, a couple angstroms. So if you think about that sort of system, it's not necessarily clear which mathematical problem is going to be describing an experimental situation. In the case of gels, I guess you would need separation in the order of a couple nanometers. Is that right? Well, that's the scale of the stuff. But actually, if you got the bottom of the gel to pick off even a nanometer off the surface, if there really were that separation, wouldn't the forces have dropped basically to zero? They don't have to be on the scale of the internode spacing, do they?
Well, it depends on the way the chain is
headed. Okay, I'm just raising possibilities.
Depends on how you move them.
Right. So maybe in order to get this to happen, in practice, you would really need 10 nanometer scale separation, or else there would inevitably be some change that would still be adhered. But if you could raise them all. Okay, anyway. Now, the reason that this second class of solutions, ones which involve physical separation of upper and lower surfaces and where you have a vanishing stress condition, one reason that they haven't been so widely studied is that there was a series of papers by Camino and Dunders in, I believe, the mid-70s, and there was a comment on one of them by Ben Friend, who claimed that these solutions were unphysical and involved energy traveling in the wrong direction. And I think people lost heart and just stopped studying them very much. The particular solutions of Camino and Dunders involved these waves moving along materials with identical elastic constants. And so I think they were problematic. But if you put together materials of different elastic constants, or I think there's numerical evidence that if you put together materials with even the same constant but rough surfaces, then things like this can live. So I'm going to tell you a little bit more about them. But there were clearly some mathematical problems. We'll see those in a minute. The most maybe the most puzzling one is that if you look at the solutions, you in the continuum, you predict that cracked surfaces oscillate and cross each other infinitely often, no matter what you do.
Because you don't put in any repulsion in right?
Correct. Well, you do, but just at the linear level, and it's not enough.
Would this be appropriate if you did a shift crack instead of a type 1 crack?
This is for mixed mode loading, and it therefore applies to shear cracks. So let me get to that. So the sort of mathematical problem you pose is one in which you have an upper surface of, let's say, a soft one, and it's on a hard interface, and you suppose that there is a region where the stress vanishes and that travels. So the vertical, a stress-free boundary, and that thing travels. And you can look at the properties that must exist at the tip. Now, this is usually done under shear loading conditions, but I will tell you later, or within the next 2 minutes, that this doesn't have the normal interpretation, that stresses rotate as you go into the thing. So even if you think you're opposing shear at the top, the system makes up its own mind about the direction that the stresses are being applied by the time it reaches the tip, and that may have no relation to what you thought you were doing. That's one of the weird things about these solutions. And that was found by Max Williams in, I think, around 1959. So normally, you suppose something like that exists. Now, normally, at the tip of a crack, either mode 1 or mode 2, there's a singularity, which is r to the 1, which the displacement is r to the 1/2, and stresses and strains are r to the negative 1/2. But here, the singularity is r to the 1/2 plus I epsilon, where epsilon is real, and if you therefore just take the real part of that to see what the shape of the displacement is, it's square root of r times the cosine of epsilon log r, and that means it just wiggles forever, and I have it plotted here on a logarithmic scale. So these things are really only, you better have a cutoff before you get to the first wiggle and things interpenetrate or something better happen. But you should worry about this. Can this be a sensible thing? Incidentally, if you look near the tips of the ones where you've imposed the condition that the surfaces remain flat, I believe there's a singularity still. Now it's in the stress, and the stress oscillates logarithmically, if I recall. So you can't pose a problem that evades these problems completely, as far as I know. The height of the system enters. You can't separate it, but if you just go near the tip and look at the distance from your continuum mathematical tip, which is r, this is the shape of the singularity that you get from the mathematical problem I described. Well, at r equals 0, everything diverges. As this always happens in a crack problem.
Right, it's some cutoff range or something. It's long, then.
Yeah, it's
killer, and you don't get a whole lot of rotation.
Well, we'll see later that you can get a lot of rotation. If you have a system that's a centimeter high and you suppose the cutoff is down at a couple angstroms or at a nanometer, yeah, you can get a lot of rotation. Depends how fast it's moving, depends on Poisson ratio. I'll give you a graph later. I'll give you a formula for that. It's given by the speed at which the crack is moving and by the Poisson ratio. And I've taken this lower material to be infinitely rigid, but if it's not infinitely rigid, then it depends upon the ratio of the elastic constants. So let's see. I have a movie. I have to show this movie. I think it'll work. Maybe it'll work. I don't know. It doesn't work. Okay, never mind. I can show it later. It's actually a full MD from which this was extracted, so you can see that. It may actually be running. It's just... No, it's not. Okay. So forget that. Anyway, I can show you movies later. This is something about analytical solutions, because you can go right ahead and solve this problem analytically, too. It's harder. The normal Wiener-Hopf technique doesn't work. You have to extend it to something which involves 2x2 matrix Wiener-Hopf stuff, and it's a little bit more numerical, and it took Eric Gerdy about a year to figure out how to do it. He did it. It's recorded in his thesis, and that's about it. You do get these same sorts of velocity gaps showing up. Here's a solution of a near tip field there. Here's the structure of velocity of those solutions versus loading. All the same things we saw for mode 1 cracks are showing up here. And this is mode 1 stuff, too. This is, what we do is we take a system of a fixed height. This one happens to be, these plots happen to be for a system of height 5, which is not very big. So take a system of a fixed height, displace the top things vertically by some distance and horizontally by some distance. You choose whatever distances you want to displace them. I'll call them D in a second. And then you just look for steady states running along the interface. Right. So there's dependence on the height of the system, n. In the fracture problems I was familiar with, these curves become independent of system height fairly rapidly. By the time you have something 50 high, there's no more dependence on the height of the system. Here you can still retain independence of the system height, but only if you continually rotate the displacement that you apply at the top. And once you understand the theory for that, then you can obtain solutions that scale onto each other, but the taller the system gets, the more you have to rotate the boundary conditions at the top. And then the solutions at the tip look identical, and you can't tell the difference between them.
But is it only log-type scaling?
Yes, right. It's log-type scaling of the system height. Okay, so I can only get one tip at a time from the atomic methods. So let's see. This is what I was just talking about. Here's the rule. So if I compute in the continuum the rate at which this thing epsilon, which tells you how the stress rotates, take two systems, one at height n, the other one at height n prime. Take the ratio of n prime to m, raise it to the 1/2 minus I epsilon. Then, if I have imposed boundary conditions for the system of height n, I put those in the denominator, and then I have to find displacements d prime y, d prime x, to make this equality true, and those will produce an identical atomic scale tip solution. And the shear and longitudinal speeds enter into that, one with a real part, one with an imaginary part. So that's more complicated than saying all results become independent of the height of the system. Here's how they depend on the height of the system. But it's as these things go, it's a pretty simple relation. So in particular, I claim that that should apply experimentally. This would say that if you take two systems of two different heights, you compute this thing epsilon, I can give you the formulas, and that tells you how you should change the boundary conditions at the top in order to have the results, the microscopic results, independent of the height of the system. So that's a specific prediction if this is the governing physics. And I would say that's probably the main definition of the governing, of it being the governing physics, would be that scaling relation helps reduce the experimental data. Here's just a demonstration of that claim. Here we are doing simulations in which we rotate the boundary conditions opposed at the top, and then we look at the details of the solution near the tip. And for very, very small systems, there's some variation, but as you get to larger and larger systems, provided you rotate the stuff at the top correctly, you go to some universal curve of near-tip behavior that extends out further and further and further as your systems get larger and larger and larger, eventually tracing out some infinitely large near-tip solution. Which region?
Near the displacements. Clearly, in the previous picture, the strains were far outside the elastic limit of any potential bending.
No, that's not. That depends where you have it fail. Everything is scaled by the failure point. So if you have things fail at 10% strain, the nonlinearity, then everything's going to be on the scale, except within one or two atoms of the tip, everything's going to be, 10th percent strain.
So what was your criterion in the previous one? It must have been like bigger now. strains were more like...
On magnify, those pictures are, let's see, you mean here? These the vertical scale is blown up by a factor of 25 here. If I show you the simulation, it's gonna. Maybe I need to show you the movie.
Well, so those aren't atoms.
They are. I've just expanded for the purposes of illustration. The.
But the atoms are so close
back. Let me. All right, here we go. Let me see if I can show you this fine movie. I don't know why it didn't show. Let me see if I can get it to go. And if the system gets, well, let me just see if I can find the movie. I'll say that. All right, here. This may work. Why is it not? It's very sad. Okay.
But Mike, you see what my problem is just when I look at those blue dots far away from the crack tip, and they appear to be isotropically arranged in the closed path lattice.
Right.
So if you're really showing all of the atoms, then it's hard for me to see how you can have different magnifications in the X and Y.
That's why I want to show you the movie. You can decide for yourself.
Unless you just started from
just a second. Come on. Could it be having trouble because this display is the wrong size? I don't know. Okay, I'm going to wait just a few more seconds and see if it decides to show you this. But it's been a couple of years since this picture was prepared, but I remember that Eric did something because to magnify all of this stuff, because people would look at the movies and they would say, that looks totally flat. So he did something, which I think just had more to do with graphics than anything else.
If you don't scale the position, but the displacement...
Yes, I believe he scaled the displacements in the vertical direction in such a way as to enormously enhance the appearance of motion. What's annoying is that I had, could not get, this is a fully parallel code running on a laptop. I have no idea why. I ran it in my hotel earlier.
It makes sense if it's the displacement.
It is. And it's a lot flatter than that. So, I've never put viscoelasticity into the interface calculation. Yeah, I think that you would get the lattice trapping would go away, is what I believe, if you started adding viscoelasticity.
It
would be all smoother. Everything would be smoother.
Yeah. Is the simple explanation for why the dissipation is important in that regard? Basically, you break this bond, you release energy, and that energy can help break the next bond.
Right.
And if you dissipate it rapidly enough, it doesn't have a chance to do that, and you can lose enough energy, and you can't break the next bond.
Right. So the simple story is, if you put in a lot of dissipation, the only way you can get it to move at all, you can't initiate till you get to the end of lattice trapping.
Right.
And then when you get to the end of lattice trapping, the first thing that you get, because you've reached the end of it, so everything's unstable, and then the first thing you get is a slow, gooey crack. So you think the Griffith point is a little bit higher than it really is, and then it's the first thing is slow and gooey. I guess that's all I can say about that.
Can you say a little bit, if you're not a rough interface with similar materials, it's going to give you the close solution in the dark
matter? It's not mine. I believe, I would have to hunt. I believe there was an article in Pure and Applied Geophysics about 7 or 8 years ago making that claim, and I haven't verified it, but I thought it was intriguing. No, I haven't done that, but I remember hearing about it and thinking, oh boy, that's cool, maybe I should investigate that at some point. But so anyway, Don asked about this epsilon. I have the complete expression here. Much good it'll do us. But I have plots, which at least illustrate it. That's how long the calculation is, okay? It's just, you know, algebraic stuff. And you get epsilon out of it. Let's see. And here are plots of the value. So one of the things you see is that as the cracks, that first of all, you get the largest rotation when the Poisson ratio is, as the Poisson ratio decreases for a Poisson ratio of 0.5, that is for an incompressible material, it's as small as it can be. So rubber, I guess, should have the smallest one. Right, so I'm assuming my bottom one is totally rigid. Okay. And then my upper one is soft, and I'm talking about its Poisson ratio, and then I'm talking about the speed. So the smaller Poisson ratio, the bigger the constant epsilon is, and the faster the rotation you get, and the faster the rupture moves, the more rotation you get. It's infinite in these calculations, so it disappears from the calculation. I don't have those expressions. Yeah, you'll get it, but I don't have the expressions. We could work. I think it's in the literature. I just don't have. I mean, it's this.
So you can tune this to get any crack speed you want.
Well, for given boundary conditions, there may or may not exist a solution, and then the crack will travel at the speed it wants. Generally, in these models, which are at zero temperature and have no viscosity, something between 20% of the Rayleigh wave speed and the Rayleigh wave speed. There also exists intersonic solutions, by the way. We found those as well, but I don't have any plots on them. They don't learn anything really new that hadn't been learned already by the cohesive zone models. So like a very, very similar story. Well, you just need what these calculations say is that for any level of compressive stress, there exists a level of shear stress for which you can, and the two are roughly comparable. So if you have tension and shear of roughly the same order of magnitude, then it's possible. Well, here the friction coefficient comes out to be 0.2.
Right, but I'm dropped.
Yeah. No. This friction coefficient doesn't enter. I don't know the relationship really of this to friction coefficient. I'm just saying that the mechanics lets you get tension under great compression just so long as you have comparable shear. Yeah. In a frictional picture, yeah. Right.
At the interface, really,
just in that core.
Right, just in the core area.
It's not over a.
It rotates. As you go away, it continually rotates.
Yeah.
So, who knows? Just depends on the scale at which you look. Yeah, let me see if I have this.
I guess the point is it's conceivable to get. Look, sort of more one fraction.
Sure, it doesn't matter how big the compression is, just so long as you have shear on the same order of magnitude.
Yeah.
So you just need a big, big mixed mode load relative to the interface, and then this mechanics is possible. That doesn't mean it happens, it just means it's possible. And, you know, there had been all these objections that the solutions were unphysical. That's why I wanted to get examples in something where I'm just solving Newton's laws. So I have those. Those tend to be fairly small systems. Then you can argue, well, those only exist in very small systems. If you had a larger one, you couldn't. That's why I have the scaling laws. And so I think the picture fits together.
In infinite oscillations or something, they go away once they're at any dissipation?
No. I don't think so. They go away because they're cut off at small scales. Dissipation isn't going to kill them particularly. Dissipation changes the dynamics, but dissipation does not tend to change elastic singularities.
So would you argue these kinds of things happen regularly in those fractures?
I don't know. I really don't. I wish you guys would tell me if they're at all plausible. I've told you the properties of these solutions. I don't see any reason why they can't exist. I've never heard a compelling argument against them. But I haven't seen the... Yes. Probably you can't have things of the same modulus, although there are hints that with a rough interface, maybe even that can be relaxed. And that's a point which I don't understand fully. Yeah, here are continuum solutions for that. So that's actually not. This is for continuum of a soft thing on a very hard thing, and it can all be repeated for elastic contrast. And Yehuda's worked all the elastic contrast stuff out in detail.
Yeah.
So the solutions were still there. Okay, I just don't have any of that, but it's not hard.
I'm interested. I have these papers that I can
see. But, well, I think one of the things I'm interested here is the continuum. You don't have the lattice stuff, right? And so that
reason. No, you don't know. Continuum, you always have to put in a dynamical rule, and you can put in whatever you want. So if you choose to say beyond this energy, you know. At this energy flux, you don't get any motion, and there are two branches, and the upper branch is moving at this speed, and the velocity is forbidden. That's as consistent with the continuum as anything else anyone guesses. Continuum never gives you a velocity stress relation. You guess it. Put it in from experiment. Get it from wherever you want.
But through the form of the stress weakening law, or do they put in an extra velocity dependent?
Well, typically,
we've done a number of different models of what's happening with the crack tip, but there doesn't seem to be very dependent on that. So there was a criticism of this stuff at some stage because it was thought to be opposed in the sense that there was added stability. Any repulse that you generate with in finite time goes to zero length and an infinite stress. Yeah, so the first one was a Coulomb loop, but then he put in different types of friction laws in there, and that's not a problem. If you still get the atom stability, it's cut off by the. It doesn't seem that the. Is a crucial problem.
I guess what I'm trying to understand, one of the things one might know is whether this describes what's happening in some real system. And it seems that the natural scale for the velocity that comes out of these models is something like the shear sound speed. Now maybe you can lower that by lowering lattice trapping and things. But is that a fair statement that it seems to be the sort of speed that Yehuda typically has as well? And so then when we start talking about something like a Shalimov wave, can that really be in the same limit, or is there something else like a buckling instability that's going on that's sort of stated, which means it's
is somehow not in the same universality class as these solutions.
Well,
it's some sort of intrinsic non-linear deformation, I guess.
Well, I guess to resolve that, I've always heard same things about Charlemont waves, but I've never checked. So the question would be, how simple a model on these grounds could I put together that would account for everything in the Charlemont waves? And that would require a new set of experiments on Charlemont waves, I think, to get very detailed velocity loading plots. And then if I could get all of that out by simply putting in measured dissipation for rubber, dissipation in rubber has been measured. If I could just stick that into one of these models and get it all out, then I wouldn't feel I needed to invoke extra nonlinear stuff. And if that all came out wrong, then I guess I would.
So
haven't been done.
In Charlemont waves and these types of self-healing.
No.
And I would start to say the same thing.
Well, yeah, so they're rubber placed on a plate, and you slide the rubber, and you can see waves going by. And papers on that often claim that this is related to very, very special things about the rubber. You know, special relaxation properties of rubber.
Jim Bruin came years ago on long
foam rubber. Yeah. Right, but are those the same? I don't know. The people who believe them about rubber would say those might be different, and the foam rubber ones might be more like this. And there's Steve Brown, who did experiments granite on granite with plexiglass. It was a fairly compliant system, and he claimed to see things that were both subsonic and supersonic racing around. I don't think he convinced many people with that, although I thought his experiments looked pretty convincing. Yeah, so, and that's a pretty brittle system. That's a hard, brittle system, but it was granite on granite, so there wasn't much elastic mismatch, and so now you would have to invoke something like roughness to explain where these solutions are coming from.
The Charlemont waves, from what I remember, they go more like the sound field.
It depends which.
Most of the studies that people have done in
elastomer.
Well, wait a minute. The shear wave speed in rubber is very low. The longitudinal wave speed is up in the thousands, but because the Poisson ratio is near 0.5, isn't the shear wave speed really low?
But viscoelasticity of soft rubber, which you observe easily in Charlemont wave, is very high. So viscoelastic losses usually are high.
Uh huh. But what's the?
Is it required to observe the Charlemont wave or? Even the fact that you need something very soft to observe.
Well, it sounds like we need some new experiments to me.
I think someone was saying the other day that the shear speed is around a meter per second, and certainly some of these Charlemont waves, no meter per second.
It would be the Rayleigh wave speed that would be limiting things. So if shear is low, Rayleigh's below, and.
Those which have been observed.
Mm-hmm. It's okay. I mean, if you give me a lot of dissipation, I can get things going. Give me non-zero temperature and I can get things going slowly. Surely rubber is at non-zero temperature. In other words, these analytically solvable things are nice, but there's certain qualitative features, which is very clear, are particular to the conditions that make them solvable, zero temperature being one of them. So we have to be aware of that.
To my knowledge, Charlemont waves have been observed with systems which have some edge,
mm-hmm.
namely a well-defined nucleation site,
mm-hmm.
In order to an edge at which it is very easy to generate this form by bucking. You know, so I wonder whether Charlemont waves could be observed with edge-free system.
Well, here's another MD simulation, again with an edge. There you can see all the atoms involved.
Well, your velocities are not necessarily the Rayleigh waves. You have the spectrum velocity.
Yeah, and we can get intersonic solutions too. Kinetic energy.
But you can also get subsonic. Well,
yes.
Well,
both subsonic and intersonic branches exist for these interface waves.
Well, I guess I'm just not sure I see the fundamental difference between Chalmers waves and these things. Maybe we just don't know enough, is this way of saying that it's an analogy, it's a wave of separation. That's basically what we're saying is the Chalmers wave.
Right, it's just there exist claims that things about the Schallmach waves are very, very particular to relaxation of rubber. And therefore, I think to be certain that that was not the case, and I think it's still generally believed that is the case, it would be necessary to have a good model not involving that, that was able to account for non-trivial features of the dynamics. And that just hasn't been done, so I think all I can say is I don't know. When? Yeah, you hit it. Closes, and there's collision.
Okay, so you have a...
Now, that width, the opening width,
yeah,
would be another parameter, and its relationship it is tied to the velocity of propagation.
Yes.
And typically, if the velocity of propagation goes down, does that width also tend to go down?
Oh, geez.
That width must also go down because of the vertical.
So here are solutions. I have here. All right, so I think the answer to your question is probably somewhere in here. Let me see if I can figure it out. So pose the question again, Mark, and let me see if I can answer it.
So how does the width of the pulse,
yes,
scale with the velocity of the front part?
Sadly, all of these solutions here are going at, these are all going at the 0.8 of the Rayleigh wave speed, of the shear wave speed. So these are many, many solutions going at that speed, and
what about the other one over there?
They're not labeled by velocity here. They're at many velocities, but I don't have them separately labeled in that way. So I can't tell. I would open up Eric's thesis and see if he has any picture.
But these are all very high limit. I mean, I guess when you go to something like finite temperature,
right, or at viscosity, or
down in two orders of magnitude,
yeah,
below this, which would still be meters per second,
right,
scale. How would the width scale?
I don't know. Would have to repeat the calculations. And probably I would do it with dissipation to get those low velocity solutions.
You look like you're getting Mach waves again in that simulation.
I don't think they're Mach waves. There is an abrupt event where there's a crash.
But it looks like you have these propagating oblique fronts. Is that from the
Yeah.
But now.
Well, that's it's not. I don't think this is a supersonic solution. So when everything settles down, it shouldn't be a Mach cone in the end. It should. The radiation should be able eventually to get ahead of the pulse. I mean, you do see.
Now.
What?
But that could be something with a question at the end.
It never reaches the end because when it gets near the end, we paste more stuff on.
Okay. Well, that's what I was asking. What are you going to do? So it's crashing.
It's crashing against the bottom here. When here, this comes down and whomp, so that creates their stuff. I mean, why is there this sub? I think there may be. I think it breaks. And then it actually opens up a new one ahead, and then those two merge. There's it's something like a cavitation event. It's sort of complicated. But the main thing is it doesn't die. It survives some really nonlinear stuff. You see?
But you're nucleating another crack and something else has come up with an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah.
Is that generic?
I don't know. I mean, all I know is that this seems to be robust enough that it can survive sort of crashing. Its belly comes, it does a belly flop, it whops against the bottom, and then it somehow springs back and keeps going.
Okay.
And that's a typical long-term behavior of the people.
You run it long enough and carefully enough, and you eventually get to a very nice steady state. But if there's any dirt lying around, which there would be, I think you would always be seeing transients in this question of robustness.
If you look right at the end, there's an extra layer in some region there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a major plastic.
I mean, there's the ledge. So if we made this a more ductile material, I'm sure we could get dislocations spewing out.
What aspect, the length of the swell, do you think it is related to epsilon?
What fixes the length? That previous plot I showed you showed that there exist just huge numbers of different lengths that the pulses can have, and they first of all, and they also carry different amounts of slip that differ by different integer values. So there are these families, and then you have to argue about basins of attraction. I don't know.
But generically, you might think that the ability to rotate to change the width of the pulse.
Yeah, but lots, that's true. That has to do with this matching between front and back. But there appear to exist just vast numbers of these things at many, many different lengths, even for a given speed. That's what that previous plot was supposed to indicate.
I imagine it would always be the limit where it wouldn't go into the compression department.
So look at this plot. This is the family of solutions, all of which are traveling at 8/10 of the shear wave speed. And here are ones which carry 3 units of slip and 4 units of slip and 5 and 6. And these are length 218 up to a length of 676. And then these are the stress conditions that allow those things to propagate. I mean, there are just lots and lots and lots of solutions. I think we should go to lunch. That's my professional opinion. I don't know the answers to lots of these questions. I mean, I got to a certain point. There are a lot of experimental questions. There are tons more theoretical questions. I actually have a student working on this problem right now, but the aspect of it that he's working on and the funding source mean that we need to focus on what happens to these sorts of things in the presence of large electric fields. So in a couple months, I should be able to tell you if you have rough sliding interfaces with asperities and very strong electric fields permitting charge transfer, what that will do. I don't know what it'll do. That happens to be the aspect of this I'm pressed to work on right now. Funding changes the direction of research. But some things we do for fun, and this was mainly done for fun. And I still would like to show the movie.
So. They're well enamored with steady-state solutions, but crashing and spewing off a lot of radiation is kind of interesting. Well,
I can do lots of things numerically.
So is that something that's typically going to happen, or is that...
I mean,
are these solutions generally very unstable and they tend to like to trip over themselves?
That movie that I showed you was one student, I had the first student, Erica, worked on it. And he got to the point where he was able to get these things, took some futzing around. I had another student who set up the thing, and that movie I showed was his very first simulation. He just sort of set it up, crashed the two blocks on top of each other with the